That worked out perfectly in sequence. So, guys, the gentleman from Vanatu, here to talk about their products and their
company. Great, thank you.
We got a clunky old recorder I'm trying to record video on that's not horribly popular. Well, thank you, Dave. Said I'm Gary. Rick, we are basically the working part of Vanatu. Vanatu has other people involved in it and has had over time, but we're basically the two main guys in the company. Kind of give you an introduction to us and what we're going to do tonight. I'm an AES associate member. I usually make a meeting or two a year. A lot of you look familiar. I don't get here often enough to really know everybody. I ran a set of speakers by Mike Bateski and Rick Chin up at Opus 4 a few months ago. I think we were there in February or sometime. It's quite a while ago. And we spent a little bit of time wondering if they would work well in a studio environment for low-end studio monitors. I was going to get those back for Mike tonight, but I think he's got something going on in the family, so he's not here, unfortunately. Around that same time, we offered to speak at one of the AES meetings because, you know, you're always looking for people to come in and talk about things. We're always looking for people to talk to. So after a few months of kind of going back and forth, I kind of asked about this month. It's like, hey, we need somebody this month. You're on. So as of about 2 weeks ago, this all kind of came in. And the request was, you know, you guys can talk. Really kind of want to hear you talk about your business. You know, what is it you designed? How are you doing things? Maybe how did you get something built in China? You know, let people ask questions. But, you know, don't really want a big sales pitch out of you guys. So I won't give you a big sales pitch, but I think it's okay that end of the evening, if you want to, you can go to Amazon.com and get them, okay? They are available there, okay? So, but I won't give you a big sales pitch. So. One thing I'm kind of curious about before we get going is I kind of heard what people did, but how many people here actually make a living in audio? Okay. I hope that if we come back next year, he is jumping up and down, very excited, saying, me, okay? We're not making a living at this yet, but it is our job. Soon we'll be making a living. We're on where we want to be. You want me to go on, don't you? Okay. I always think it's good when you kind of know what you're going to hear tonight. So here's kind of overview of what we're going to do. First off, you know, I don't want to stand here and talk for an hour. It said try to put together a pitch that's about an hour, and I think it's about that. We'll see. But please ask questions. This is supposed to be an informal session. You know, this is not a lecture.
Just to get it out of the way, how much is it there?
They come in two finishes. The cherry that's here is $549. The same box painted black instead of finished is $499. So.
And they're on Amazon.
On Amazon and on our website.
And that's delivered.
That's delivered to your door. We pay free shipping. You know what that really means? It means we pay the shipping. Okay. Free shipping just means you don't pay the shipping, but somebody still does. So, you know, ask questions like that. And what I'm going to show you is more or less a chronological history of what the company is, but reality is kind of spaghetti. When you're putting something together, you're doing a million things at once. If you knew what we actually did in order, it wouldn't make any sense to anybody because it probably didn't make sense to us. So kind of chronological order. I'll give you a little bit of background on Rick and I and on Vanatu. We'll talk about entrepreneurship, and probably a bunch of folks here have started businesses and know a lot more about it than we do. I don't have any claim that we're entrepreneurial experts, but I can kind of give you our take on what we did. We'll talk about the design cycle. There's quite a bit in here about how we actually designed the speakers. The manufacturing cycle and what we did with our Chinese business partner who's making them for us. What we're doing for distribution and sales, kind of what our marketing and marketing system is and what we see in the future for us. And then, as Dave said, after the break, we'll hopefully listen to a little music so you can hear what they actually sound like. And, you know, as you can see, they're not very big speakers. They won't fill this room very well. But when it comes time to make music, maybe, you know, get a little closer. So you are way ahead of me, man. Okay, so Rick and I are the main guys. Rick has the title of CEO, and what that really means is he's the guy that does the books. He agreed to do the accounting and things, so that makes him the CEO by definition.
Actually, what it means is I drew the short straw.
he was willing to do that part. By training, Rick is an electrical engineer. What he doesn't want you to know is that he grew up on a farm in Iowa and started life in a one-room schoolhouse. Okay, and his father was a self-taught electrical engineer who I think had a day job kind of farming and stuff, but basically repaired two-way radios. That was his business. So Rick basically learned his love of electronics growing up working on two-way radios with his dad and fixing stuff out in the farm. Went off and, you know, went to college and became a real double E. Moved out to Seattle area in the late 70s, I think, and has been here ever since. There's only two of you get to pick your title, so I'm the Chief Technology Officer. I'm a mechanical engineer by training. I grew up working on go-karts and motorcycles. Built my first pair of speakers in high school. I tried to make them look like outhouses. My brother-in-law said they were birdhouses, so I built these little birdhouse speakers. They were better than what we had at home. You know, I've been hooked on speakers ever since. We met at a company called Tally. Tally Genicom, management Tally, had a couple different names over the years. It no longer exists, but it was a major printer manufacturer that was in the Seattle area for about 60 years. When we left, Rick was the VP of R&D, and I was a director in the engineering department. So we went from engineers to basically running the department before we left. And we left in 2007. Before we left, there was about $500 million of products in the field that we were the primary designers of. So we were either the primary designers or the project managers, program managers on getting the thing out in the field. So over the last 10 years or so there, everything that left out of the factory was stuff that we had designed and all the peripherals for it. So there's quite a bit of stuff that's still out there that had our names on it. In 2003 or so, we were bought by a private equity firm, and they kind of have their own way of doing things, and they didn't really want to invest in anything new. And after we pitched a few things to them saying, gee, can we do this, kept getting no. It's like, you know, we're done with this. We want to innovate. We want to make something new. We don't want to sit here and squeeze nickels out of vendors. And we'd start talking to each other about, gee, what do we really want to do? It's like, you know, audio is what we really like. Electronics is what we like. You know, music and sound is what we like. So let's go do something new. So we both quit. We didn't aim to, but we actually quit on the same day, right after we got our bonus for that year. There was a reason it was that day. It was a little later than we expected, but we took that summer off, you know, paid to the kids and did things. We regrouped that fall of 2007, and our goal then was to decide, is there really a business opportunity here? You know, we knew we were done working in the old place, and we wanted to take the summer off after 20 years of working. Then the question was, is there a way to make a living doing something else? So if you go back to 2007, right, this is a little bit chronological. You know, what was going on then? You know, you read the business book, and it tells you, gee, the great time to get into a business is when there's disruption in the market that you want to be in, because that means things are changing and opportunities are being created. So we kind of looked around 2007 and said, gee, you know, music, you know, CDs have come out a long time ago, analog is dead, vinyl's kind of made a resurgence since then, but basically music is almost 100% digital. Legal downloads have finally arrived. You know, iTunes had just hit a billion right about that year. Not just iTunes, but the App Store from Apple is supposed to hit 50 billion sometime next few weeks. They got a contest going on to give away stuff. 50 billion now, but they just hit a billion then. Streaming music and internet radio stuff were just starting to kind of come on. But all this stuff was locked to your computer. Or maybe you might get it on your iPod or on your MP3 player or your computer. But you really had a hard time getting it around your house, even though 802.11 was starting to become ubiquitous. You know, that's about the time when everybody could figure out how to do a network in their house. Class D amps, which is what we have in here, they were starting to get to the level where they didn't suck anymore. You know, they used to kind of, and even some audiophiles were starting to say, oh, I can actually listen to it. So some of the technology was changing. You know, people started getting used to small speakers. Bose, who, you know, the audiophile crowd doesn't love, but maybe they're jealous of their success. They started making small stuff, making it cool.
At some point, can you describe what a Class D amp is?
A Class D amp is an amp that basically runs in a switching mode. So the output of it, in a normal amplifier that people are used to, AV amps and stuff, you have a transistor that acts like a rheostat. It controls the current going to your driver, the voltage going to your driver. A Class D amp, and it, you know, ramps up and down smoothly with whatever the signal is. A Class D amp kind of works like a switching power supply. It chops the signal really fast, and it creates the signal by sending little pulses to it and making those, the height of those pulses simulate what the signal is supposed to look like.
How fast does it sample it?
In our case, the switching frequency of the amp is 384 kilohertz, I think. 385 kilohertz is the switching frequency of the amp.
Is it your own design or is it OEM?
No, it's off the shelf. It's off the shelf amp. So.
Oh, I see.
Well, we customize. You'll see some of the block diagram. We customize a lot of stuff around it.
Looking forward to it.
Who's in the B&O?
No.
It's a D2 audio. So, no, it's not. It's not ice power. That's out of our price bracket. You pay more for the amp that we're doing. So we conclude. Oh, and a big deal. If it's in blue, that means it's a big deal. It didn't seem like a big deal to us at the time, but that was also the year the iPhone was introduced. And the iPhone basically set the stage for changing the whole market that we're trying to get into. That was a really big deal. We didn't know it at the time, just this cool new thing from Apple, but that really changed everything. So we looked at it and said, gee, there's enough disruption here. There should be some opportunity. So now there's opportunity, but what are we going to do, right? And so we actually spent quite a bit of time saying, gee, are we going to do a service or are we going to do a product? You know, I like the idea of a product because, you know, you can sell it. You don't have to be there. It just somebody buys it. Rick liked the idea of a service because it takes a lot less time usually to get into it. You know, the product development side can be very long. If we'd known how long it was going to be, we might not have done it. After a lot of going back and forth, we said, ah, let's do a product. We want to be a product company, not doing service. So great, are we going to sell stuff? Are we going to go find things to sell? Or are we going to go make our own? Well, we're innovators. We're going to make our own. And then are we going to, you know, I used to be the manufacturing engineering manager of the printer company for a few years. Are we going to build this thing? Are we going to put together a factory? Or are we going to go have somebody else build it for us? It's like, you know, we're not going to build a factory. That's just incredibly capital intensive. We're not going to go do that. We're going to get it OEM'd by somebody else to make it for us. So we kind of looked at that and said, okay, so what are our strengths? What do we know, you know? I've been a speaker nerd for 30 years. Maybe somebody in this room knows more about speakers than me, and I wouldn't be insulted by that, but I've read almost everything that's ever been published on speakers in the last 30 or 40 years. Rick is a rare guy because he knows both analog and digital electronics. He kind of came into EE about the time that digital was really starting to hit. He knows both ends of that and networking, which is not something a lot of people know. So he said, gee, they are really our strengths. And what are the needs out there? We need to get music out of people's computers and get it around the room. So that's the combination of stuff that made sense to us. So, you know, ding, 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 the bell goes off. Let's make a wireless powered speaker. That sounds like the perfect thing to fit this opportunity. The market needs it. We got the know-how. And we love this stuff. This is kind of where our passion is. But then there's, oh, my God, that means now we're going to do this thing. This is real. You know, we're now entrepreneurs. So when you become an entrepreneur, that's the question of we're going to be an entrepreneur in audio. We all know this one. How do you make a small fortune in audio? All right.
Start with a big one.
So here's what we know about entrepreneurship, and frankly, it's not a lot. There's lots of books written on it, and we read some of them. Recommend you do that. But as far as I'm concerned, anybody that hangs out their shingle, they're an entrepreneur. You're out there in the world trying to make it. I think the first three questions you probably need to ask yourself are all kind of related, which is, what do you want to do, why do you want to do it, and is there a market for it? Those three questions are kind of, the first two is kind of about you, you know. Why do you want to do this, and what is it? But you got to make sure that somebody wants it, or you know, the coolest widget in the world that nobody wants didn't do you any good. Do you believe in yourself? Because it's going to be a long slog. You know, there's going to be stuff that goes on that just looks like you're never going to get there, and you got to be willing to believe you can pull it off, and you got to face the fact that most small businesses don't make it. You know, we're not out of the woods yet. We are on track to do what we're supposed to do. We like where we are. We're happy with things. We got a lot of enthusiasm, but you know, we're not out of the woods yet. You know, you got to be able to be in a spot where if you don't make it, you're not going to go broke, and you know, your wife's not going to throw you out the door. So we're not out of the woods yet. She may make me climb the ladder and then jump off. You know, what kind of business are you going to be? And we actually, this might sound silly, but we actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. You know, how big are we going to be? Are we going to go try to hire a whole bunch of people? Are we going to get a bunch of other people's money? You know, are we going to go try to be the big startup that you read about, that you're on the cover of Inc. magazine and all that stuff? Or are we going to kind of go off and, you know, be a little business that makes it in the world? And after a lot of thinking about the market we were trying to enter and the kind of investment you're likely to attract and what the opportunities really were, we said, you know, there's an opportunity here to carve out a niche and make a good living doing it, but we're probably not going to be the next Microsoft. So let's be realistic about what we can actually accomplish and kind of aim at that. So is that any questions on that to make any sense? So, you know, the other thing I think is, you know, you got to do your homework. I'm not a business guy. I'm an engineer to my core. But the nice thing about Tally, where we worked for years, we had engineering, the factory, and marketing and sales all in the same building. And it was kind of nice because as I ran the factory for a while, did design products for a while, you worked hand-in-hand with the marketing sales guys on a regular basis. So it was actually a very good training ground for Rick and I to kind of see the whole business and understand things. So we had some of that background on it, but I wasn't really a business guy. We brought a pile of stuff here, probably an absurdly big pile of stuff, but for example, some of the business books and stuff that we looked through and some of the startup books, some of that stuff is very helpful. There's great books on startups telling you what to do and what not to do. You got to know your competition. You know, the primary guy in the market looks like us is Audio Engine. They make a speaker that's a lot like us. We have some things over them. We sound better. We got better features. We're a little bit smaller. We have better finishes. To a lot of people, they can do the same thing. You know, you got to know your competition. You got to know what you're bringing to the party. You got to know who your customer is. You know, what they want to buy, and how, you know, how they get it, why they buy it. You know, we made a list out of what we thought our customer profile was going to look like. And just about 2 weeks ago, I dug through the first 8 months of customers on Amazon, looked at who they really were, and got on the web and looked them up. Right. Which is kind of spooky.
I'm not supposed to tell them that.
I don't like the idea of people doing that to me, but you got to know who they are. And, you know, they are very close to exactly what we thought going into it. You know, so you got to kind of know those things. But you got to know how you're going to get to your
who
customer.
Who was that?
Huh?
Who was your market? I mean, you just said you looked them up. I'm just curious. Can you give it
in a... Yeah. I mean, basically, our primary market is professionals. It's pretty much 40 and 50-year-olds. Professionals making good money. They live in higher-income neighborhoods. Software engineers, we have for some reason a high percentage of university professors, which is, at least one of you is here. A lot of university people, a few doctors, a few lawyers. It's pretty much all high-end professionals that have disposable income that are willing to spend $500 on a set of small speakers that sound good, right? And they care about sound, or they wouldn't be buying them, because you can buy cheaper things, but they're not going to sound as good.
What we don't know at this point is whether that's just due to the way we've marketed the product so far, because we've had professional reviews done, and that's what people in that demographic tend to do, is they read reviews. We don't have any YouTube videos, and the 30-somethings like to see YouTube videos, so that's some of the marketing strategies that we're looking at.
But so far the people buying are pretty close to what we thought they were going to be. And we're going to try to broaden that a little bit with some other things, but that's about what we thought. And you got to know how your customer is going to find out how you exist. And we'll talk about what our plan was and if it's working. You got to know your costs. That's in blue, because if you don't know what things are going to cost you, you're not going to have control of your business. So you got to know your budget. And you know, if you're a small startup, there's no such thing as not my job. Something's got to get done. Somebody's going to do it, and it's either going to be me or him. The other thing we found is that there is no shortage of people willing to give you advice. And a lot of it sounds good. A lot of it kind of sounds bogus. Some people you can kind of tell this is not good advice. But you can get a lot of great advice, and it goes all different directions. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's your business. You got to decide what you're going to do. So.
I got a con. I talked to a guy that was a business guy. His advice to me was, the very first thing you want to do is get a T-shirt with your company's logo on it. He went bankrupt, but...
But he had a lot of T-shirts?
I got a couple of really nice T-shirts. Yeah.
You took your shirt off his back, didn't you?
Yeah.
I'm keeping this one. In our case, we tried to pay attention to corporate structure and things. You know, I would advise, don't skip on legal stuff. You know, get everything you need to be in place. Don't take anything off. I've known this guy for 25 years, right? We get along great. We don't argue about stuff. I think we've only really been mad at each other like once in the last 5 years, and only lasted a day or two. But still, put things in writing. You know, that's how you keep out of court and keep from having problems with each other. And don't agree to anything you can't live with. We have a partnership agreement that very much, it's legally we're an LLC with the state of Washington, limited liability corporation. That kind of defines our legal structure of the state of Washington. They don't require that you have a fancy detailed partnership. They do require a little bit, but it doesn't have to be super detailed. We have a pretty detailed one. It says how we would dissolve the company, how we would sell it, you know, what happens if one of us dies. I mean, we have all that stuff in place. We spent a lot of time thinking about that ahead of time, because that's real life, you know. That's down the road at some point, maybe. You got to understand how you're going to divide labor, who's going to do what, not be arguing about all the time. And in our case, we are largely a virtual company, meaning that there's two of us. We're trying to put together a real company that sells products and has a coast-to-coast reach. There's lots of stuff has to get done that we're not going to be experts on. We're going to go hire that stuff out. And we're not going to go hire people to work directly for us. We're going to go find contractors to do it. So things like our website, and, you know, Amazon, things you'll see later, all that stuff got hired out. So So we decided there was an opportunity. We put together the kind of the company. Now we're going to go design the product. This is the stuff we like, right? We're engineers. We're going to go design the product. So now we're in the design cycle. Where do you start your design? You got to start it with what do people want. If you're going to go sell something, you better not go make a cool widget and then see if there's a market for it. You better go check out the market first. So there's lots of reports out there. There was reports available from ABI Market Research on streaming media and what everybody wanted. They wanted like, $4,000, $5,000 for a 40-page report. You can read the summaries. You can find people that report on reports. You can find a lot of information without buying the big reports. So we did a lot of that, looking through and finding out, what people are saying and what's selling out there. One of the things we found right off the bat was everybody wants wireless, but really nobody knows what that means. Most people, if you say, I got a wireless speaker, they want something like a Jambox, which there are no wires to. That's wireless, and I get that. But most speakers that you can send music to wirelessly, you got to plug them into the wall. You got to do something. There's a wire somewhere, but people think there's no wires when you say wireless. So there's a bit of an issue there. That stereotype that men want the big speaker and women just don't want to see it, that's actually true. There is market research that says that. This is not, it is a stereotype, but there's truth to it. And it's also true that, if you go to anybody that ever sells stuff in the store, they'll tell you, oh, bass sells, man. You rock the bass and that gets people's attention. So, gee, ding, ding, ding again, make it small with big bass. Okay, so that's not a real surprise, is it? That's what everybody wants, but that's where we set off on it. Out of all that, what we found was, gee, does anybody really care about the sound quality? And we were told by more than one person in the audio industry, as long as you don't suck, you're golden. People really said that to us. I thought, maybe it's true, but that's just a horrible, horrible, cynical way to treat your potential customer, right? I don't want to act like that. So to us, it's like, look, we're going to be a little better than just don't suck. And it's important to us. We think it's important to our customers. And we think it's important to how we want to get our product out there. So we spent a lot of time making sure that we were better than just don't suck, which frankly isn't a very high threshold. So we're going to make a wireless speaker, right? So we go off and start looking at wireless stuff. Actually, before we even quit our jobs, Rick bought a wireless point-to-point system, paid god-awful amount of money out of his own pocket for it. He's probably still holding some papers down somewhere with that thing. There was a lot of wireless chipsets on the market. Most of them are point-to-point, meaning you could plug it into your computer and plug something in the other end of them and send a signal from one to the other, but it's just this thing talking to that thing, and it's not on any other network. It doesn't know anything else. It's like, don't really want that. So then we took a good look at Bluetooth. And I have to say thank you to my good friend Mike O'Leary, who is not here, but he coined the term huzzah for hardly sucks at all. And when Mike runs across something he thinks is really cool, they kind of look at it for a while like, that hardly sucks at all. Well, Bluetooth isn't quite to that level. Bluetooth kind of still sucks. It just wasn't quite good enough for what we really wanted to do as the built-in only way to communicate with the speaker. We looked at Universal Plug and Play, DLNA, Digital Living Network Alliance. Those buzzwords might ring some bells. These guys are positioning themselves as the new wireless way to control everything. Your refrigerator to your garage door opener to your network. It's a nice system. It kind of works. There's servers built into it in Windows. Everybody can talk to it, and none of this stuff actually works. It's just absolutely not user friendly. This guy's stuff doesn't talk to that guy's stuff, and this control point doesn't work there, and it's nerdy and geeky as all get out. We could probably make it work. The people out there in the world that are customers, they can't make it work. We could barely make it work, so that was off the table. The company called Avega, you guys know what Sonos is? So Sonos is very successful, great company. We didn't look at them because they're not going to have anything to do with us. Okay. There was a company called Avega that was looking like a Sonos clone back in 2007, 8, 9. They actually had $7 million in funding from Cisco Systems and some other people. We tried to talk to them, and they basically said, come back when you grow up, kid. We're still here. They're gone. So maybe they grew up and got a job. I don't know. Looked at Apple AirPlay. You had to have deep pockets to buy into the Apple infrastructure. I think maybe it's come down some now. But at the time, the people who were making the chipsets, you just couldn't get access to it unless you're going to push god-awful volumes and had a lot of money.
Well, actually, at that time, it didn't even exist, right?
Well, it just started, right? Because we're talking to Bridge Co., who was doing it
right
in like the second year of our existence. So, again, this isn't completely chronological. It's kind of roughly in a way to make sense. So, you know, there really was no good choice for building the wireless in. And anything you did pick was going to automatically exclude half the people because it wasn't what they were going to use. So, ding, 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 you know, bell goes off again. Hey, let's not build the wireless in. You know, let's build a box that can connect to anything else and let people choose their own wireless adapter. That has some nice advantages, actually. If you're an Android guy and next year you buy an iPhone, well, you might need a different thing. You don't want to go buy a new $500 speaker system because you switched phones. Wireless standards haven't been around forever. Things change. You know, technology updates. A couple years from now, there's going to be something new, right? This thing's still going to work with it. It was built in. It wouldn't work with it anymore. So everybody wins. If you just say use the external box and don't build it in, it's a great solution. Yeah. Does that make sense to you guys? Makes sense to me too, but... You know, we talk about marketing here a little bit later. People say you have about 8 seconds to get your message across. Explain that to somebody in 8 seconds of why you're better off not to have the wireless built in. Tough to do. So still in the design cycle. So here, we got our design goals now. All small speakers, just virtually every small speaker you buy has something that comes from the BBC of the LS35A monitor back in the 50s. They all have a little bass and a boost at about 100, 150 hertz. That gives a little bit better sound and gives the illusion that there's more bass there than there is. And then most of them are a little soft on the top end. Somebody had this theory that if you don't have bass extension, you don't want treble extension either, which I don't know why that is. I don't think I completely
buy
that.
It goes back to the telephone company.
Well, okay. But they did, yeah, but they had a bandwidth that wide.
No, seriously, when they did the research, they found that if you limit bandwidth from 300 hertz to 3K, it's the most natural sounding voice that you can produce over a POTS line unless you go full bandwidth.
Right, okay. Well, so we decided that we weren't going to do the little BBC curve of boosting the bass. We were going to have an honest to God real bass response, keep the thing flat. We wanted to be below 50 hertz. We wanted to be to 41 hertz originally, but you just couldn't get there in a box size we were going to live with. The box had to get quite a bit bigger than the one we have, and that was kind of one of our constraints. We wanted a small box. And we were willing to give up. You know, so we didn't know how big was, but we didn't want it very big. And we didn't know how loud was, but we wanted it to reasonably loud. So reasonably loud, as small as we could possibly make it, and keep the bass down below 50 hertz. And then we turned to what all the experts have to say, right? We're going to go leverage what, you know, the 30 years of reading and research we did. So, you know, you probably know who these guys are. You know? That picture actually came from the AES website. Neville Teal, everybody know who he is? Mm-hmm. So, and Richard Small was the guy that took his work and basically made it popular and known out there. Floyd Toole talked to this group 3 years ago. Great presentation. It's a little intimidating talking to you, but I know he's been in front of you. Because very impressed by him. Anybody know who Wolfgang Klippel is? Okay. You guys know what Toole did? You guys?
Yeah.
Okay. So. Klippel is a German guy who has a professor in Germany, and now has a pretty good sized company. Every time I see a picture of his website, there's more people in the picture in the company. He basically makes equipment for characterizing, among other things, loudspeaker drivers. And he can tell you all the weird non-linearities and bad behavior the speaker puts out, and then he can tell you what that might sound like and what you should do to try to fix the sound that your speaker makes. Speakers are about the most non-linear, badly behaved thing in the face of the earth. That's actually one of the reasons why when you read most of Small's papers, he makes a big deal out of small signal analysis. Run your speaker with very, very little signals and make these measurements because, gee, if you turn them up at all, you're going to get a different measurement. Klippel tells you how to adjust some of those things. So this is kind of the design cycle we went through. And, you know, maybe it seems pretty simple, but, you know, we put together a good model. There's a million speaker models out there. We didn't use them because basically, in my little pea brain, if you use the same model everybody else uses, you'll make the same thing everybody else makes. So we kind of went back and looked at, you'll see what our model looks like. We kind of went back and looked at the basics of the speaker and said, you know, what's a better model of this that we can understand? And I never liked the deal small models because those guys were double E's and I'm a mechanical engineer. And no matter how I try, I can't turn a capacitor into a mass and an inductor into a spring. It just doesn't work in my brain. So I like springs to be springs and inductors to be inductors and, you know, magnets to have a barrel problem. So we put together our own model. We measure the heck out of what we put together. And we listen to it. You know, imagine that. We actually sit down and listen to these things. So, and we kind of go around that loop and say, gee, did we achieve what we wanted? And do we understand why we got what we got? And does it measure that way? So. I won't belabor this much, but this is a simplified model that we have, and you know, you got a mass that's the cone, you got the squiggly line is stiffness, so you got a box springiness. Boxes have some leakage, which is a little. After I said I won't belabor it here. So this is the stiffness of the box. This is box leakage. This is the mass of the cone. There's radiation resistance that the cone has pushing into the air. This is your voice coil circuit. The driver itself has some damping and springiness to it. So this is kind of the basic electromechanical model of a speaker. And that's kind of the crudest representation of it. We have more advanced ones beyond that. So after looking at lots of models and everything we could do, we kind of settled on a more or less sixth order design, which was something that Thiel wrote about in his 1961 paper. It's a technique where you, in speaker terminology, a sealed box with no port is a second order system, meaning that the bass rolls off at 12 dB per octave. You put a port in the box or a passive radiator, that now becomes a fourth order system, meaning that the bass rolls off at 24 dB per octave. And you know, according to Small and Thiel, if you do everything right, you can get a little better bass extension. If everything is held kind of the same, which never quite is, the advantage of the port and passive radiator over sealed box is you get a little better bass extension. Or you can be a little more efficient for the same bass, but you buy a little bit with those extra degrees of freedom. A sixth order is something you accomplish by electrically assisting a thing. So basically you have a ported or passive radiator box that has that roll off of that 24 dB per octave slope, but then you tune it a little too low so the bass sags, and then you boost it electronically to get it back to flat. And depending on your setup, you can extend the bass by maybe almost as much as half an octave. So you can buy quite a bit more bass, and then in the out-of-band, really low frequencies, your filter rolls it off. So the old problem people had, you know, 30 years ago with a turntable and your ported speaker where you got the woofer doing this from the warp, record warp, you get rid of that because you roll off the real low stuff. So that's basically what we have. It's not really sixth order, but it's essentially kind of a sixth order thing. It's flat below 50 hertz. We settled on a 3-liter box, which is basically what this is, 5 1/4 inch woofer, and you can't get the tuning, the thing's tuned to about 50 hertz. You can't get that tuning with a port in this size box. You need a port that's physically longer than any dimension in the box. I spent a couple months of my life digging through all the stuff that's published on how to make ports flow, and you just can't get there from here. So we went to a passive radiator, which, you know, this guy asked me, why don't we just use a passive radiator? I'm thinking, I'm supposed to be the speaker guy. Why did I not think of that? So, you know, we had this working by what we called prototype 10. Okay, we had the very first prototypes are sitting in my daughter's bedroom. Most of the rest of them are scattered to the winds. But by about the 10th version of different boxes that we tried and different woofers we put together, we had a working system that measured, had the below 50 hertz roll-off we had everything we wanted. It didn't sound very good. You know, it measured right. The model looked good. Everything matched. It just didn't sound very good.
Where did you measure it?
We use a little measurement microphone and software, and I measured in my family room. We have some other measurements that are measured in a bigger space about like this, but we use the close mic for bass, and then you bring the mic a little further away, and you can measure the higher frequencies, and you kind of marry those together, and you can get a pretty decent measurement. It's not as good as you get if you had a real anechoic chamber, but it's pretty good.
But we've got good correlation between that measurement technique and the anechoic measurements.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it works well if you're careful.
So right now, you're saying you're just focusing on the low-frequency stuff. You're not doing anything with the crossovers and the high-frequency. You're really focusing.
Well, we had a tweeter in there, and we had crossovers, everything built. And I'm not going to address all that stuff. But, yeah, we had whole systems built. But the thing that we spent the most effort on, design-wise, was trying to get the bass right in the small box. Because mm-hmm. that's what's different than what other people are doing.
Right.
So that's really where all the effort went. Our tweeter is actually the tweeter we're using. You'll see when we take the front off is the only thing in the box that isn't custom. That's something that our business partner was already making and that we picked up. We liked it. It worked well. Sounds good.
Where's your crossover at? And is it active crossover?
It's passive crossover at 2500.
Okay.
We looked at an active crossover. We wanted to put an active crossover in there, but our chipset on our amp gave us the choice of having an active crossover. The amp's got four channels in it. And we got two speakers. We can take those four channels and drive, you know, woofer and tweeter on both sides with an active crossover and using a DSP. Or we could take the two channels and drive each side with a passive crossover and have a subwoofer out. Mm-hmm. And we decided to go with the subwoofer out routine because most people understand what a subwoofer is. Very few people know what an active crossover is. And for the market we're shooting at, it kind of made more sense that there was more value added in the subwoofer output than in the active crossover. So.
What measurement system did you use?
The software I use is Sound Easy, which is a $250 Swiss Army knife of speaker design. It's actually a great program with the world's worst user manual. I've had this thing for years, and I can do about 10% of what it does. You just cannot decipher half the functions of the thing, but it's got good measurement capability. It's got good modeling capability. It's actually a very good program at a low price, and it has measurement capability built in. So use your PC sound card and a calibrated mic, and it works real well. And freeware, something called Room Equalization Wizard, does the same stuff, and it's open source. I haven't used it, but I think it works real well. So we went back and said, gee, you know, why does this thing just not sound good enough? And we spent a lot of time looking at that, and we kind of concluded that it was the most likely culprit was the fact that inside the woofer, you'll see the Klippel curve here in a minute of the woofer that we had in that model that we didn't like. And there's a lot of change in inductance over the stroke of the woofer. And in our case, it's a small speaker. When it's putting out bass, the woofer is working its buns off. We got about a 5mm X-Max, and it's using it. It's going that full distance when you're playing it loud. And the sound we didn't like is when you were playing loud bass signals with mid-range in it, there was just a harshness in the mid-range. It didn't sound right. We went back and said, gee, why is that? We thought it was because of a lot of variation in the inductance. You know, I put together a nonlinear model of the speaker that was able to predict what it should do, and it said that the heavy bass was giving me about 4 dB of modulation of the mid-range signals. So the mid-range signals have an amplitude modulation that's following the bass signal, and that just doesn't sound good. Probably most speakers do things like that, but that wasn't what we wanted. So we went back, and there's a local guy here from Linwood area. Anybody know
Dan Wiggins?
Did ring a bell? He's a local guy. He's got a patent on a woofer called XBL, and it's basically a split gap design where you have two magnetic gaps with a voice coil in between, and it does a couple things for you, but it basically linearizes the BL curve. So how much motor force there is inside your motor stays the same over a really long stroke of the voice coil. So you'll see one of the curves here in a minute that shows what it looks like without that. But it basically flattens out, gets rid of a lot of the distortion from a long stroke woofer. And in our case, the reason we wanted it isn't the reason he really sells it. He sells it for the bass capabilities. You don't really hear the bass distortion that much. But in our case, it also flattened out the inductance, which was causing a mid-range distortion, and that's why we really wanted it. So we licensed that technology from him, put it in. And oh, by the way, we're working with the Chinese factory, and everything is iteration after iteration to get it right. 5 more rounds of prototypes where we finally get the combination we want. Finally get it all put together, it measures right, model matches the measurements, and it sounds good. Gee, we got a design. I won't belabor this one too much either, but these are Klippel measurements. And this here is you can't read it very well, but this is the motor force, BL, which is basically how much force the voice coil puts out when you put current through it. And what you really want is this to be a flat, straight line across here. This axis is displacement of the woofer. So zero here is with it sitting in the middle, and then displaced either direction from center, how much force is it put out when you run current through the coil. You want that to be nice and flat across the top. This bell shape is what virtually all traditional woofers look like. Almost all woofers look like that. The XBL thing, I'm not going to show you the curve for that, but the XBL thing is nice and flat across here. It varies almost nothing over the 5mm of X-Max that we want. This curve, Klippel does, is the stiffness of the suspension in the speaker. So you've got the surround and the spider that give the speaker its restoring force. If those things vary like crazy over displacement, then the speaker doesn't behave very linearly, and sometimes it gets a big offset. You know, you see speakers that when you put power into them, the cone jumps out one way or the other. That's usually from big offsets in this curve. And this curve here was a culprit that we think caused most of the distortion we didn't like, and this is the inductance versus stroke. And so it was, you know, here's the center of the stroke. It was very different from one way versus the other. And when I put that curve in my nonlinear model and ran a simulation, that's what told me I was getting about 4 dB of
What drivers were you using
previously? Were they off the shelf or they're custom made?
No, all this stuff was custom made by our Chinese partner. So the very first couple of prototypes we built as kind of proof of concept that our sixth order system was going to give us the base we wanted, those were some off the shelf drivers that you could buy in a catalog from MCM here in the States. But as soon as we engaged with the Chinese partner, everything came from them. And they provided a lot of value add in the process. We originally started with a 4-inch woofer, and they're the ones that said, "Why aren't you using a bigger one?" And they told us to use 5 1/4.
It's interesting you engaged them that early in the process.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that early, but it was a long time ago.
I had a question.
Sure.
So you had Klippel measurements. Who's doing the Klippel measurements for
us? That came from China. They have a Klippel at the factory, so they were able to do them for us and send them to us. So they would build something, measure it. Not every prototype I had in my hands. A lot of those prototypes, between about 6 and 10, most of them I didn't have in my hands. They would build something. They would send me the measurements. I would say, no, you got to tweak this a little. You got to tweak that a little. They'd build another one. They'd send it. They kept thinking I wanted something different than what I wanted. So this looks kind of like the other one, but this is the more complete model for the passive radiator system. So this extra mass over here, which has units of mass, this is the weight of the passive radiator, or mass of passive radiator. It has its own stiffness and damping. This is how you kind of model the box. This little lever arm here is kind of the fact that, if you don't have the same cone areas, one moves more than the other. And when you start looking at the voice coil, you can actually put a crossover in if you want. In this kind of a model, you can put the crossover components in as part of the drive circuit and see what they do. To get a good match of the impedance curve of a speaker, they don't look like a resistor and inductor. There's a little more to it than that. This kind of model comes from Klippel and does a much better job of matching what that impedance curve really looks like over a wide span. So we got the basic speaker design. Simultaneously with that, we're also working on electronics, right? I mean, you don't do one and then the next one. We're working at the same time on that. This is really kind of Rick's bailiwick. But early on, we listened to a bunch of Class D amps. We had 3 or 4 or 5 different models. We sat down and listened to them. And, to the audiophile group that we belong to, that's heaven. Everybody knows you listen to things. I don't know if everybody here necessarily sits down and listens to their electronics. But by God, I'm not the most golden-eared guy that ever lived. They don't all sound the same. Did you? Okay. They don't all sound the same. And our reference system was an NAD preamp, an ADCOM amp from the late 80s, early 90s. Decent mid-fi linear stuff. Of the amps that we tried, the one that sounded the most like our reference system was a D2 audio. I really couldn't tell the difference between the D2 audio Class D amp and the linear stuff. Our business partner really liked a little amp from ST Micro. They make lots of them, and they're really, really affordable. You hook it up and you sit down and listen to it, sounded about the same. But you sit there and listen to music for about 10 minutes and you had to leave the room. You can't measure that. It doesn't show up in distortion plots, but you just can't sit there and listen to it very long. There's something about it. So the D2 audio is the one that won out. And oh, by the way, we really did pick it for its sound quality, but it has a killer feature set, okay? This amp, you'll see a block diagram over here in a minute. But it basically runs in. he told me I was going to go more than an hour, so I'll try to speed up here. It runs in the digital domain. The whole front end of it is a digital. It's basically a DSP. The whole thing is basically a microprocessor for all practical purposes. It runs in the digital domain at the front end. And it runs at 48 kilohertz and 24 bit depth. So it's got good noise specs. It supports direct digital input into it, so you don't have to have if you're coming out of a digital source, you can go directly into it.
Does it do sample rate conversion on the fly then for 44
wide? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. It converts everything to 48/24 and that's what the DSP is all based on, is 48/24. So everything's converted.
Everything that comes in gets turned into that. So
all of our digital inputs will handle up to 96K/24
it shifts it to
48/24.
Yeah. 48, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a latency that's
latency? Well, the latency through the system's less than 3 milliseconds.
Yeah, it's not very high. Nice. And
it's
it has
long.
Nice
that's longer than it took my voice to get to your ears.
You can play with it.
And it has a nice programming front end. Somebody's asking
less than, sorry. Less than. Sorry, go ahead.
It took short enough.
Kibitzing.
We actually have an analog input. Yeah, it was given that the system had to have an analog input, but since the amp runs in the digital domain, you know, all the audiophile guys, DAC is the hot word in the audiophile world. We actually have an A to D in ours to convert from analog to digital, because if you send an analog in, the system doesn't know what to do with it. It has to have digital input. And we wanted USB, because we wanted to be able to hook it up in the computer world. One of the guys from the Audiophile Club was the guy that recommended that to us, and was also the people that said, yeah, get rid of this, get rid of the bi-amp and go with the subwoofer out, because more people know that. So this is basically the block diagram of it. Again, I won't try to belabor it too much, but this is the main D2 audio chip that does has the DSP built into it and does the pulse width modulation output that drives the output transistors. The main big blocks in here are the D2 audio chip, the control processor front end here, which is basically the custom part that we had added on. So somebody asks, is the amp off the shelf or custom? This chip is basically off the shelf. The output transistors are basically off the shelf, and you have your choice there. And depending on what output transistor you pick, that sets how much power you can get out and what kind of distortion you get. But the front end here is all custom to us and was all designed by our Chinese partner to our specs. And we have a control processor that looks at the inputs and says, gee, you know, which input has a signal on it and which one am I going to play? There's a hierarchy of which signal you're going to play. Analog always wins. If there's an analog, that plays, and if there's digital input, it gets shut off. There's bass and volume controls go through here. And there's a separate tenor part that takes in the USB input and turns it into SPDIF. That's what the amp wants to see.
Is there a wireless component to this as well?
No.
It did turn out you didn't do the wireless.
We did not build the wireless in because...
you do it externally.
You use the external box, because then when something changes, you just go get a new external box and you keep the speaker. So. That's basically what the block diagram looks like. And there's a subwoofer output, and it has analog output to a sub, so it looks like your standard subwoofer output on your receiver. You plug that into your sub, and you're off to the races. So.
Is it
one
a sub for each speaker, or just one?
No, we built all the electronics into one speaker, and then you run a wire from one to the other.
So it's
speaker
2.1. It's 2.1 when you have a sub.
Yeah. Right.
And when you plug a sub in, we... automatically sense that and do the crossover for you. So all you have to do is just adjust your sub volume to taste and run its crossover to the greatest point.
What's
or turn it off.
125. The automatic sensing on the jack, the DSP switches when it sees it, cuts the bass out of us and sends it to the sub. So
based on the block diagram, it looks like the USB does not have ability to talk to the control processor.
Correct. It's strictly an audio input. And that tenor device identifies itself as a USB audio device. And that's the thing. Because of that chip, you don't need a driver when you plug it into your computer. Because it says, hey, I'm a USB audio device. You know, I know how to talk to you right off the bat.
But it also means that there's no way to do any kind of remote control for volume or tone.
Right. Now, yeah, you can't control through there. No. Which I think goes back to your question about the crest of the system earlier.
Yeah.
So you can't talk to it. Floyd Toole. When he was here, these are the measurements he talked about. In this case, these measurements were made in a room more about this size. It was my church. We built a turntable. We put the speaker about 10, 12 feet in the air. We got the microphone way up in the air. We were reflecting free time of about 16 milliseconds, which means that the measurement's good to about 80 hertz. And I don't know how many of you remember what Toole said, but he basically said that what you want is a speaker that's got flat, on axis, and listening window, which is like 10 degrees or so either side of the axis and 5 degrees above it. So, you know, people right out here in front of your speaker, they should all be hearing the same thing. And then he said you want the power response to gradually decrease. And the way he defines that is you measure 72 points, 360 degrees in a circle. So if you go every 10 degrees, that's 36 points in a circle. Draws a circle vertically around the speaker and a circle horizontally around the speaker, and you measure 72 points at 10 degree increments all the way around it. We built a turntable. We built the ability to set a speaker upright and sideways so we could spin it in two directions. And we made multiple sets of 72-point measurements to generate these curves and see what they look like. And basically, looks about what Toole said. We got a little bit of a bump in here. Theoretically, it should be a little bit smoother in here. Most of that's due to that's where the crossover is. tweeters have a wider dispersion than woofers. That's something that's pretty normal in most two-way speakers. Your woofer starts to become a little bit directional. And I think some of that's also we got to suck out in the crossover. Above the speaker, 10, 15 degrees above the speaker, we got a bit of a crossover suck out, tend to exaggerate that. I won't stand here and tell you that every production speaker looks like that top red curve, because that's less than 1 dB variation, because the scale is 5 dB per division. So not every production speaker looks that good, but this is a real measurement on a real speaker made in a reflection-free environment. So the end result from a frequency response view came out pretty good. Again, frequency response is not everything, because we had a unit that measured well that didn't sound good, but frequency response does matter. So now we got it designed. Now we got to get the thing made. We started off, we wrote a nice product spec of what we wanted. We went around and tried to find somebody to make it. We met with a company called Misco, which is Minneapolis speaker company, billed as being like the last American speaker company, which isn't entirely true, but kind of true. The guy, Dan Digry, the guy that owns the company, his father started the company on the GI Bill after World War II. He's probably a little bit older than me. This guy was born into this stuff. We sat down with him, showed him everything we wanted to do. He took a look at it and said, I'm going to buy all this stuff out of Asia. You may as well go there. So it's okay. We're going to go to Asia. We got out a copy of the Loudspeaker Industry Sourcebook. Okay. How do you know who to go to? This little book published once a year tells you basically who makes stuff all around the world. We had a checklist of what we wanted. We wanted somebody who could do some driver design and make the thing for us. We wanted somebody that had a box factory, because some people just make voice coils. Some people make just magnets. We wanted somebody that had the ability to turnkey the entire thing for us. So a box factory, driver production, the ability to do some electronics. So we want the amp, not just a passive speaker. And very important to us, we wanted somebody that had a U.S. office. Because we both did OEM work with Asian vendors in our previous career and did project management for keeping people in Asia. Working across 9 hours is hard to do. So we wanted somebody with a U.S. office. The guys we ended up with have an office in California. Shortlist companies, got two quotes, got a quote from a guy in the Philippines, a guy in China. Chinese company won our evaluation overall, and so, now we're doing business in China.
Can you tell us who the company is?
Meilun Industrial. They're just in Dongguan, which is this big amorphous area between Hong Kong and Guangzhou, so down next to Hong Kong. So I didn't put Meilun in writing because, our presumption could have, but you pop the woofer out, you'll see Meilun written on the power supply, so it's not a big mystery. Dave, somebody suggested, tell us a little about doing business in China. You can take it for what it's worth. This would be my thing. Costs are important, but everybody thinks you need to run off to China to save money, and don't do that. That's important, but that's not the reason to do business in China. If the only reason you're going is to save money on something, that you're probably doing it for the wrong reason. You got to make sure that you got clear lines of communication. In our case, we don't deal with China. We deal with the guy in California. He deals with China. Look at their customer list and make sure that you're not trying to use somebody who's just getting into the business. You go in Meilun's, they got two rooms literally about the size of this one, just packed full of stuff that they've made for almost every speaker name you've ever heard. I wrote down, so it's everybody I've ever heard of. They've made stuff for over the years. You got to take advantage of what somebody knows how to do, and don't expect people to go out and make something new for you, especially if you're a small company. If you're Microsoft or Intel, you might get somebody to make something new for you, but if you're me and Rick, you better go work in their sweet spot and ask them to do things they know how to do. If you're asking people to stretch, you're not going to be happy. Repeat yourself ad nauseum, because they're not going to figure it out. You got to have a schedule, and they won't meet it. You should go visit the factory and make sure you know what you're getting into. In our case, we went and audited their quality system. They got a good, pretty good quality system. Harman Kardon is their biggest customer. They do tons of work for big name brand people. But don't trust it. We went and hired a third-party inspection company that, once our stuff is built, the third-party company comes in and inspects it to our specs and takes units out of the boxes and measures them and double-checks everything. And they find little stuff. They don't find big stuff, because the factory's pretty good. And so far, they haven't tried to pull one over on us. They're good about that, but they make mistakes. These guys find them. And lastly, they're not idiots. These guys are working hard. They're like everybody else. They're trying to make a living. They're good people of integrity. They're trying to get it done. And, you know, they have people come in their factories and treat them like they're inferior to them, and they don't like that. You know? The Chinese factory was an integral part of the design cycle, and we wanted that, okay? We wanted to own the, and some of this comes from our previous work in printers and working with other people. We wanted them to basically own the quality of what they did. And they were going to do the circuit board layout and design. They were going to get the boards built and all that stuff. We weren't going to dictate everything we wanted them to do. So we wanted them to own it. We own the features and the performance and all the final decisions. But we wanted them to actually own the quality. If there's ever an issue with it, we never wanted to hear them say, well, we did what you told us to do. We never wanted to hear that. It's like, no, you did what you did, and we got a problem with it. So it's very much an iterative process. They never really understood the design we were looking for, particularly in the base section. For a long time in electronics, they didn't know what Rick was wanting for. And in the woofer and stuff, they didn't quite know what we wanted. And they don't do models of stuff. They just kind of try to build things and see if it works right. So we went through this build, test, and iterate cycle for like 18 months. That's how we got to roughly 15 prototypes. About every month, we crank out another one, and we try it and see if it's what we want. And the electronics went in circles. That Tenor chip that we use on the USB converter, Rick did an exhaustive research of everything that was available, identified that part, told them this is what we want. They said, we can't use that because we're unwilling to sign the non-disclosure agreement with that company. It had something their legal guys didn't want. So they spent 6 months telling us all kinds of other things we could use, all kinds of other things we could use. We kept saying, no, that doesn't do what we want. That doesn't do what we want. After about 6 months, they came back and they said, hey, look at this Tenor part. This is really cool. How about you use this one? And Rick kind of held his nose and said, yeah, okay, let's use that one. But that's the way it works. You know. These guys are pretty good, okay? We got a good relationship with them. They were a valuable part of the overall process. The end result here is a far better speaker than what was in the spec sheet that we originally started with. The good news is, after all that time, we probably made bad business decisions because every time there was a question of, are we going to do this or this, we always defaulted to, well, let's do the better one, which kind of drove our costs up some. But we wanted to be better than just don't suck. We wanted to be better than that. So we always took a little higher one. Again, we hired a third-party inspection company, and Rick's done a lot of work on coordinating the international shipping. You know, they get it to the dock in Hong Kong, you've got to get it where it's going to go. So you hire somebody else to do that. Rick's, again, he's the CEO. He takes care of that stuff. So thank you, by the way. So now we're into, we got the product, we had it made, now we got to get it out there and get it sold. So, right off the bat, I mean, long before you got the product, you got to know how you're going to sell the thing. You know, you're going to go retail or online. We decided we're going to be primarily an online person, online entity, because there just isn't a lot of shelf space for audio. You know, the classic stereo stores are mostly gone. If you're going to try to get in a mass market thing, you got to have some deep pockets to get in big box stores. And the kind of product that we were looking at isn't a good fit for big box stores because it's a little bit techy, it's a little bit geeky, and you know they got 19-year-old kids selling that stuff for the most part. They're just not the right place for it. And pretty much audio has gone online. You know, almost everybody's selling stuff online. That's the reality of the market. That's where our competition is. And frankly, there is a reason. You know, it is true that when you eliminate the middleman, you get a better deal. Typically. Telling Greg earlier, most retail electronics products you see on a shelf at a Best Buy or something, the price you're looking at is four or five times the manufacturer's cost to build the thing. In most online companies, it's not that high because they're competing with each other and they do give you more value for your money. And we give you more value for money in that same regard. So we decided we're going to go online. And we decided fairly early on we wanted, you know, we weren't just going to sell from our website because who's ever heard of Anitu? We're going to put things on Amazon, and in fact, we're going to put them in Amazon. You know, not only are they on the Amazon website, but they're in an Amazon warehouse. Amazon does not own them. Amazon does not sell them. Amazon is a catalog for us, and they do our fulfillment. We own the inventory. You know, so they didn't buy them at us for some super discount and then turn around and sell them at a high price. They basically charge us a pretty fair value for warehousing them and shipping them. And having them on their website, it's pretty affordable for what you get out of it. And they have 24-hour-a-day coverage. It's a name everybody knows. If people never heard of Anitu, they trust Amazon. You know, they don't like it, they know Amazon's going to take it back. So,
did Amazon have to vet you guys to make sure you were on the...
You know, not very much.
As long as we had a bank account and a credit card, they were happy.
I think that's about it, yeah. they're pretty good about it. They're hard to deal with because, you know, they were a startup not very long ago, and they're a mega monolith now, and Rick does all the communication with them, and it's kind of like beating on the door of the ministry and waiting for somebody to answer. You know, they don't respond very fast, but
they can do all of the logistics of shipping. You know, pick the goods, you know, box them up and ship it for less money than it costs us to pay FedEx to ship it. So,
they can hold it in a warehouse for 6 months, ship it to the customer, and still cost less than if we carry it down to FedEx ourselves. And it's available 24 hours a day. We don't have to worry about it. So.
And it's Prime? Is it Prime?
If you're an Amazon Prime customer, you get the free two-day shipping. Yeah.
It's free shipping if, you know, because anything over $25 is free shipping on Amazon. If you check the right box, you got to know to check the right box. But yeah,
Amazon. Yeah, if you're not Prime, you get the free longer shipping, which is, you know, about a week. And again, free shipping. It's not free. It just means we pay for it.
Toothbrushes. And get it 2 days.
Yeah. Later, so. Yeah. If you're a Prime customer, you can get 2 days free shipping. It's yeah. Yeah.
Trying to tell me you brush your teeth every 3 days? So our primary was online entity, but we did decide to establish a retailer network, and we have 8 or 10. What do we got now? We're roughly 10 retailers in the Northwest. We got two guys that are really small that sell stuff out of their house, but hey, we work out of our houses, so I'm not knocking that. Basically, you know, one of the theories here was that an old VP that we used to work with, a guy we respect a lot, he told us, God, just give away your first 500 products, you know. Nothing succeeds like success. Get them in people's hands. We're like, we really can't afford to give away 500 speakers. That's asking a lot. But if we go to retailers, we can give away a lot of the profit we would normally make on them and have them help get them out there. So we don't make anywhere near as much going through retailers. We make if bought from Amazon. But you also see on our website that, gee, these guys have retailers, you know. We list them on our website. They list us on their website. Gives better visibility for all of us. And if you're some guy in Philadelphia looking around and you see this company out in Seattle and you see that they actually have in stores there, I think it gives us a little more credibility, you know. If a store is willing to carry it, maybe they're real. The only way for that to work for us is we got to self-distribute to these guys. There's not enough money in it for us to go through a classic distribution and have the distributor then find all these guys and ship it. That just doesn't work when you're mostly an online company. Our reception has been very good in Washington, Oregon. The stores we've talked to, our pickup rate is well over 50%. I don't know what exactly it is, but there's only been a couple stores that have said no to us. Most of the people we've talked to have been willing to do it. They see the product. They like it. They think it fits a need they have. They like the business model we put to them. And so our pickup rate's been pretty good. We're actually headed to California. We won't be at the next meeting because we're going to the show, the home entertainment show in Newport Beach at the end of the month, and we're going to be hitting California retailers on our way back up the coast, trying to peddle our wares there. So, marketing, every engineer's dream, right? that pretty much sums up how I saw marketing, and, you know. But you know, the reality is, it takes everything to get the product. You know, the factory doesn't make it, the marketing won't sell it. If the engineer doesn't design it, the marketing can't sell it. There's lots of stuff sitting in warehouses that was well designed, and the guy that designed it doesn't know how to sell it. So now we got to put on our marketing hat. Okay, now this is when things are really starting to stretch for us because we're engineers to the core. We're not marketers. Our plan going into this whole thing was that we're going to build a high-quality website that looks nice and clean and professional, and we're going to make it informative. Some of you guys have been to our website. I'll leave it up to you if we did that or not, but we get mostly good feedback. You know, a few people think it looks a little too geeky, but we get mostly good feedback. We wanted the things to be available coast to coast, and Amazon was our solution to that. So we were going to try to get it in just a couple local stores. We intended to go out and get reviews from people that review stuff for a living and get them just to like us. And that was earlier when I said, you know, we want to be above the doesn't suck threshold. That was important to us personally for our integrity. We think it's important to the customers, but we also basically wanted to have people who do know what they're listening to agree that this doesn't suck. So we wanted to be good enough that when we get in front of professional viewers, they'll say for $500, this thing's a good deal. You got to get customer reviews. If you're going to sell on Amazon, you want your customers to talk about you. You got to participate in social media nowadays, Facebook and Twitter and forums and all that. We figured we're probably in it, buying some advertising. You got print and you got online. You can do all the pay-per-click stuff. And anybody been to any audio shows, Rocky Mountain Audio Fest or any of those things? There's these roaming audio shows. There's 8 or 10 of them now around the country. There's one about every 6 weeks. And, you know, the classic stereo stores have shut down. There's just not very many of them left. And even if you live in a major city, you probably only have access to a third or at best a half of all the high-end audio stuff that's sold out there because there's nobody in your city deals with. So there's these shows that move around the country now where almost all the high-end manufacturers come and converge on a hotel for a weekend and all the wares are there. And you can see your $100,000 Magico speakers. And Rocky Mountain Audio Fest in Denver is kind of considered the biggest one. We were there last October. Had a great time. We were stuck in our room for 3 days because it was just the two of us. We never got to see anything else, but we had people coming in. And it was a pretty intense, interesting, fun time. We're going to go to a similar one in Newport Beach at the end of the month called the Home Entertainment Show. This time we got a friend of ours who we used to work with for 20 years who's going to come with us, so hopefully we escape a little bit and see some of the stuff. But they're pretty, if you ever get a chance to go to one, they're definitely worth it. So that was our plan. You know, what results did it generate? First thing before we even talk about the results is how about the product itself? You know, we've been selling through the first batch and another batch on the way. Good news is the product quality and reliability has been very good. There's been a few little problems, but out of the number that we've sold, there's been pretty few problems, and our return rates have been really good. You know, the typical return rate you hear for consumer electronics is in the 10 to 15% range. You know, there's I'll be pretty open and honest about most things. I won't tell you our actual return rate, but it's way better than that. So we have a 30-day money-back guarantee. You know, you buy the thing, you don't like it, send it back to us in 30 days. Very few people have taken us up on that. So people really do like the thing, and they've been working well. Website gets most of the good feedback. So far, we got 8 professional reviews from online magazines. None of the really big names, although Macworld, which is pretty well known, actually gave us our first review. God, it came out August 1st. The thing didn't hit. They were stuck in a truck in Indiana. Supposed to be delivered. He posted a review August 1st. A big spike on our website traffic. By about the 3rd or 4th, it starts dying down. On the 4th, the speakers become available on Amazon. It's like, missed it by 3 days. But so far, we've gotten great reviews from the professional reviewers. We won an Editor's Choice Award from a place called Stereo Mojo. Got a guy from AV Rev called us Best Buy for 2013, and Macworld, who I was just referring to, the editor there gave us 4.5 out of 5 mice. It's kind of their stars rating. They give most Apple products, and this is an Apple specific publication, they give most Apple products 4 mice. So the fact they give us 4.5, that's pretty good. So we've got 24 customer reviews on Amazon. I don't know what's with this guy. I don't know what his problem is, but 23 of the 24 people gave us 5 stars. One guy came up with 4 stars. I don't know what his story was. And he really liked him. He didn't knock him for anything. But
I think it's because we didn't have an optical cable in the box. Yeah.
Some people always want something you didn't ship them. So, you know, we tried to put enough cables in a box that you open up the box, and if you can figure out how to plug in everything, you can make music in about 5 minutes. But we don't give you every cable for every possible interconnection. So... You can tell I'm in my 50s. Maybe think I'm older than that. I don't know, but social media just doesn't come natural to me. Okay, you know, my daughter's generation, maybe. So when it comes to Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff, we're still struggling with that. We are in the process of getting better at it, but that's something we're still working on. Paid advertising so far has been pretty limited and spotty for us. We did do a print ad that didn't really do anything for us. The same company, we went back to them and said, "Gee, your ad didn't do anything. Can you offer us something else?" They did some online email. They have an opt-in email system. People have opted in to get it. They sent emails to lots of people. We did sell some out of that. And we're looking at AdWords now, which is something we're going to probably start doing. You know, I said blue is what's important. Look, really, in any business, sales are what counts. You know? Everything else is just noise. We had a business plan. I didn't talk about our business plan, but we, of course, did the business plan up front and all that stuff. We had low, mid, and high projections, what we expected in our first year. We've been on the market about 8 months, and so far we're running to our mid-range projection. And so, gee, you know, that's pretty good. You know, I can't really complain about that. And one of the things you read, one of the biggest killers of small business is running out of money, you know, cash flow problems. I got orders, and I got this guy, but I got no money in the bank right now, and I can't pay him to get him. The good news for us is we're frugal. We work out of our houses. We didn't go rent offices and spend money on stuff that wasn't going to put money back in our pocket. 8 months into it, we got positive cash flow going already, and that's going to allow us to ramp up some of our promotion efforts this year. So we're working on becoming a little better marketing people, a little better social media people. I said earlier we're a virtual company. We're going to hire some of that stuff out and bring some people in to help us with those things. What's our future? We're going to start offering some of the wireless solutions in the bundle with the boxes so you don't have to go to somebody else. Make it a little easier for people that just want to buy one thing and have it all working. We're going to look at some value-added peripherals, some of the stuff we might do, maybe some from other people. We're going to ramp up some of our search engine optimization to get found easier, a little more effort in social media. We are looking at other speaker products. We haven't decided what we're going to do yet, but you know, we can go smaller, bigger. One thing we get knocked for some people is they look like grandpa speakers. Some people say we should look a little hipper. At some point, there will be a standard wireless interface, maybe. And if there ever is, we'll go to that. And, you know, we talked early on that, you know, one of the first business books we read says, you know, if you're starting a company, one of you better be the marketing guy. We're still both kind of engineers learning marketing. At some point in time, if there was some marketing and sales guy who wanted to join us as a partner and had all the right credentials and everything, we'd be interested in that. So, and with that, thank you. You didn't ask enough questions, but maybe you just wanted me to stop, so that was the quickest way to get me to stop.